call the House Committee on Healthcare to order for this fourth day of March and talk to us a little bit about what's planned for this week. This is a healthcare restructure week, and we're going to be focusing the week on four bills. We'll hear what those bills are. The intention is to talk about today for the whole time of the session to take testimony from the governor's office and OHA, give us a chance to ask questions about the health care reform piece, and on Wednesday we'll do the same thing with health insurance reform. We're talking about all these bills are how do we relate what we need to do as a state with the ACA regulations that keep getting promulgated. On Friday, we're going to have all public testimony on the four bills that we're talking about. Three bills which have already been introduced, one which is in process and we'll introduce as a committee bill on Wednesday. And we'll hear about what those bills are today. If anybody wants to provide public testimony for on Friday for any of those four bills, we're going to open them all up at the same time. If anybody wants to provide public testimony, please let the committee administrator know by the end of business on Wednesday, because we want to know how many people want to testify. We want to allocate the time in a way that's appropriate. So please pass the word, and you all remember, if you want to testify on any of those four bills, and expect we should have a lot of testimony on those bills, please let us know. Let us know what bill you want to testify on, and we'll schedule panels for the public testimony on Friday. Friday will be public testimony, public hearing only, and we'll be working those bills into next week's schedule. Hope we'll be able to move them all out. Some of them go to Ways and Means, some of them don't, but we want to get them in the process. In addition, on Monday, a week from today, we'll be taking testimony and perhaps working the hospital self-assessment bill, which we believe we have worked all the details out with the hospitals, and we would have heard it last week, but for scheduling, we want to have some of the key people in the hospital community here to tell us how they love the bill, and we will schedule that and perhaps even work it on a week from today. So I will open an informational meeting today on healthcare reform and invite our colleagues from the governor's staff and from OHA to join us. You guys have the next hour and a half or so to educate us on where we're going. Incidentally, Representative Clem wasn't able to be here today. I hope you'll take the opportunity to give him whatever material we have to get him up to date.
It's on. Chair Greenlich and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mike Bonetto with the governor's office. And certainly appreciate the opportunity to be in front of you today to talk about really this ACA alignment. As we were looking at a number of bills, we had the concern that we could really start to have some discussions in a very fragmented way. And I think having this type of forum actually allows us to talk about kind of the multiple components around the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. So really over the next several days, myself, Dr. Goldberg from the Health Authority, and Barney Spate, who really is kind of a key advisor to the Health Authority and to the Governor's Office and really has kind of been in a point position, will kind of be going over the specifics really around the Medicaid provisions and the reform efforts around the insurance market. So what I have up here on the screen, really, I think these are the key takeaways that we're really going to be driving at. One is just to kind of have a level playing field so we all have a common understanding of the Affordable Care Act in regards to our implementation of state policy and the necessary legislative actions. And then really, as we kind of go through this over the next couple of days of, you know, what are your, you know, insights, feedback as we look at these kind of these we consider kind of critical four pieces of legislation to have a successful implementation of the ACA. So in a very broad brushstroke, I mean, this was one of the, if not the biggest healthcare reform pieces over the last 40, 50 years. I boil it down into three buckets. One labeled population health, the other delivery system reform, and the other coverage and access beginning in January 2014. The population health provisions, there were some new pieces that really we hadn't seen before in terms of really funding preventive and public health measures, community-based grants, some new things that actually I think are certainly needed. On the delivery system reform front, some new payment models being experimented with within Medicare, an innovation center within CMS. So again, some new things developing. I would say not as aggressively as probably we have been thinking in Oregon, but nonetheless, you know, that was, there were certainly some provisions there. But it's really this third piece, and this is the one that we're going to spend really all of our time on over the next couple days, with these three buckets, the Medicaid expansion, health insurance exchange, and then the insurance market piece. I have two underlined up there because those are the two that really, for us right now, require legislative changes. And Bruce is going to talk a little bit more in detail today on the Medicaid side, that we have these, we have two bills right now, House Bill 2859 and House Bill 2091, that have to do more with some technical cleanup, but then also with some programmatic changes in order to get to that level of alignment come January 2014. I don't have anything underlined for the health insurance exchange. For Oregon, that means Cover Oregon, our public corporation. Because at this point in time, we're really not looking at necessary legislative changes, but Barney's going to be here on Wednesday and actually is going to tell you really how this fits into our reform piece. But Barney on Wednesday is going to walk you through more of the details of the health insurance market changes. And this is profound. We haven't seen anything quite like this, and we're trying to figure out what are our appropriate steps to really stabilize the individual market and the small group market. So right now we have House Bill 2240 that's related to really some technical cleanups within the insurance division of what they need to do to get better aligned with the ACA. And then the fourth piece that Chair Greenlick mentioned has to do with a bill that would be introduced on Wednesday as a House committee bill that is looking at how could we potentially restructure the state's high-risk pool, the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, to be more of a backstop or a state reinsurance program. So we could create more of a glide path as we look at this transition for a period of 3 years. Much like there is a new federal reinsurance piece for a period of 3 years, we're looking at doing the same on the state side. And at a high level, and again, I'm going to defer to Dr. Goldberg to get into this at much more detail, but when you look at the provisions in the ACA around Medicaid expansion, this is really what you find at a high level. The expansion can go up to 138% of the federal poverty level. And if you look at what that translates to, that's roughly $15,000 per year for an individual, roughly $32,000 for a family of four. So you kind of get an idea of kind of what that means for lower income individuals. At the same time,
here's those numbers again, please.
I believe it's $15,800 for an individual and $32,500 for a family of four.
That's 138%.
138%.
Yeah. 15,856 for a single person and 32,499 for a family of four.
But some of the bigger issues that we've been grappling with are those percentages that you see up on the board. And that has to do with the federal Medicaid match in terms of how they are looking at covering this newly eligible population. So I think the attractive thing when you look at this is that it's 100% federally funded for the first 3 years. But as you look at the outgoing years, that percentage begins to decrease, which means that there is a larger portion of state funds that need to provide for that offset. And I think we've taken this very, very seriously, and I think you're going to hear really much of Dr. Goldberg's testimony today around a third-party analysis of how we've looked at this to really, I think, pencil out to be budget neutral. When you look at the puts and takes of the offsets to the general fund, the income from roughly $10 billion of new federal spending, this pencils out well for us. And I would say it also pencils out well with what we've done over the last several years just on Medicaid reform of having in now a sustainable growth rate, a fixed rate of growth within our Medicaid population. So again, I'm going to defer to Bruce, but this is a big piece on our end that we've been looking at and tracking. And in order for us to get to this next level of alignment, we have some critical bills that we think are going to be needed. The next piece, and this is really going to be focused on Wednesday discussion with Barney Spate, has to do with the insurance regulation. And they're really, I just put up there a high level, pieces of the insurance reform. But guaranteed issue, pre-existing conditions, limitation on lifetime limits. I mean, these have significant implications around how the insurance market is going to operate. So we have some specific house cleaning to do just within the insurance division, and this is reference to House Bill 2240. But then this other component of reinsurance and what are the appropriate backstops that we could put in place to potentially help mitigate some increased premiums, as we've talked about, this new playing field around the insurance market, as we've been calling this more or less a reset, as you kind of have a new equilibrium as we're looking at implementing all of these provisions. So Barney's really going to walk you through, I think, the details of how this plays out. We had an initial report done in the summertime called the Wakely Report that was sponsored through the Insurance Division and showed more or less the premium impact. And we want to, want you to better understand that, and then some of what we're considering some proactive measures.
And Mike, you're talking about these changes both inside and outside these.
Correct.
Changes, right?
Correct, Chair. That's right. So I guess more than anything today, I wanted to highlight what we've done and how this connects to the Affordable Care Act, because I think this is absolutely essential. We could talk about these four bills in isolation without connecting the dots, and I think it really would almost be a travesty if you didn't back up and understand all the work that's been done over the last 6 to 8 years and how well-positioned we are to leverage our work. And again, all of that leveraging is really based on how do we get better value for the dollars we're spending on healthcare. So I think this was an important piece, if you look up on the screen, that this was the National Academy for State Health Policy saying that states that have this coordinated strategic approach are going to be in a much better position to move forward and actually leverage their successes. If you didn't do what we've done over the last 6 to 8 years, I think there are many states that I've been talking to are kind of on their heels. They're trying to figure out what are those next steps. And if you do so, how do you do so in a way that's not going to break your state's budget in the outgoing years when you do have a state share of that? So just to give you a brief understanding of what you have done as a legislature to put yourself in this position, I think is quite impressive. You don't really have any other states across the nation that have really done this and laid out this strategic plan. If you go back to 2007 and Senate Bill 329 and look at the creation of the Health Fund Board and really look at what that group did, their final report really has been the basis of a lot of this work. I mean, it really has been. And I was just reading through it. And if you haven't had a chance to read 160 pages of it, it really does kind of provide this framework. And I just want to briefly highlight, they had seven essential building blocks. And this was back in 2007 when we were putting this together. One, advocate for federal changes, which you think what we've done with our waivers. Six, train a new healthcare workforce. If you think about what we've been working on with community health workers and others, ensure health equity for all. Think about what we've been doing with CCOs and the accountability metrics around that. Four, stimulate system innovation and improvement with new models of care, community-based innovation. And this really has been the framework of our CCOs. Three, unify purchasing power, which we really have done now with kind of the evolution of the health authority and how we've really started to look at how do we look at Medicaid and public employees kind of across the continuum of leveraging that. Two, set high standards and measure and report, which is what we're absolutely doing on the CCO front. And then the first, number one was bring everyone under the tent, which was really the first step with the Healthy Kids, and now what we have an opportunity to do with the alignment of ACA. So I think, again, I just want to highlight how strategic kind of the discussions in this building have been to get to this place. And this is all without ACA. So, I mean, this has kind of been Oregon's path from the beginning, I would say, in a very, very bipartisan way.
You should ask the question Wednesday how well we've done with number two on the exchange side. And so that, would you like to be interrupted as you go along?
Absolutely, Mr.
So feel free to speak up and ask questions as we go along. So go ahead, Mike.
Sure. So if you think what that framework allowed us to do, it to build upon 2009 with House Bill 2009 and House Bill 2116, but really the creation of the Health Authority, Dr. Goldberg's leadership of getting us to a place where we can actually have discussions around health reform with a single state agency, so that we can really talk about Medicaid reform and cross kind of lines within public employees as well, has given us a completely different vantage point. And then 2116 with kind of the rollout of the Healthy Kids and covering as many kids as possible. So again, we have that kind of infrastructure already in place. And then what many of you have been around for the last couple years with 3650 and 1580 with kind of the evolution and launching of CCOs, and then the same with Senate Bill 99 and House Bill 4164, kind of the evolution and launching of our state health insurance exchange. So, I mean, this is all kind of connected impressively over the last couple years. And I have a bullet point down for health reform 2.0 of really making sure that we are all clear of how we can connect our initial work with Medicaid to public employees, to the exchange, and to the private sector as well, as we kind of see the value add across all of these lines. As I talk to my colleagues in other states who are doing this, I will say that we are very rare. Many folks are looking at a Medicaid expansion, Medicaid reform in isolation. They have not connected it to public employees or leveraging purchasing power or even connecting it to the exchange. So I think when we start to look about how we are trying to really work through delivery system reform, I think you have done a successful job in connecting those dots. At the same time, I think, you know, we have taken upon ourselves of how can we best coordinate our own efforts. If you look at a lot of the work that's being put in front of states regarding ACA, it really is dealing with health departments or a health authority, an insurance division, certainly a state exchange, and our own office. For that reason, I think the governor has really been very directive that we have to have coordination, collaboration across all of these entities, that we do not want to send mixed messages. We want to have unified policies that align with what you've just done on that previous slide. So with that, really the governor has pointed Barney Spate to really be the point person within the state who's really coordinating ACA activities. So you'll get to hear from him on Wednesday, and you'll kind of see kind of what we've been talking about in terms of connecting the dots across all of our state agencies. And this is a high level, and I just put down really the higher level points that many of these agencies do, and I just highlighted the insurance division, the health authority, and Cover Oregon being our state exchange. But we are wanting to make sure that we have alignment between all of these in terms of what you have laid out in terms of state policy and certainly what the governor has laid out as well. And I think this is where it becomes interesting, where you have begun to set yourself apart from other states in terms of even how it would play out with a Medicaid expansion. You've seen something like this before, but every time you need to balance the budget on the Medicaid side, you pull one of those three levers: cutting people, cutting benefits, cutting provider rates. So we, for the first time, have looked at a different way. We said, no, we don't want to pick that the fool's option. We actually want to create our own path forward, which is how do you realign the incentives at the delivery system to get your best outcome and your best value. And this is really what we've done. I would say, when I'm talking to colleagues around the state, around the nation, many of them have not understood this or gone down this path, which means in 3, 4, 5 years, they're going to have those levers to pull. They're not going to have really the opportunity to look at how they looked at the opportunity of system-wide change and delivery system reform. And this really, in a nutshell, is what you've done over the last couple of years with the formation of CCOs and what your local communities are now trying to put together. But how do you best integrate, coordinate care? How do you do that in a way that you have a fixed budget that grows at a fixed rate of growth? Metrics for safe and safe and effective care. And how do you do all that that provides local accountability and flexibility? Again, things that we haven't done. But how then can you leverage this work across multiple payer lines and actually begin to launch this? And again, this was done way before ACA. So how can you actually use the ACA as leverage to actually continue this work forward? And just so you know, you have 15 CCOs across the state all doing those boxes that I had on the previous slide. Doing a new way of business, new alignment, realignment of incentives, and designed on obviously some overall health outcomes that we haven't been held accountable to in the past. And I would just close by saying, you know, this really has been the vision all along, whether it's in this report from the Health Fund Board, 6-7 years ago, what you have laid out, 2-3 years ago, even with the evolution of CCOs. But how can you begin to connect the dots, what we're calling Health Reform 2.0, where we have taken some amazingly proactive steps on the Medicaid front, but if we just do that alone, I would say we have a high probability of failure. So how can we begin to look at other purchasing lines, whether it is public employees and schools and the exchange and private employers, to leverage that change and harness that change? So again, I just want to more or less provide the context for what you've done, and then we'll get into some more of the specifics around the Medicaid and the health insurance side over the next couple of days. So with that, I will turn over to my colleague. More questions?
Mr. Chair.
If you just speak up and ask, that'd be great.
Okay. Mike, I was just wondering, conversations have ever came up on some of the expensive care that we do, cancer patients, things like that, to where we're going to look at possibly only doing one chemo treatment or look at age, whether or not we provide chemotherapy, if those discussions have taken place yet or been discussed, because that's where a lot of the cost is in this, and we're going to be limited budget funds on what we can put out per patient. And just want to know where we're at on that, or if those are even coming up yet.
Or if we can expand that question, talk about how the list, the prioritized list, plays into it, because that's where that kind of
right.
Are we still alive on the prioritized list?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Widener, I would say yes. I mean, that still is a part of what we have today in terms of using our prioritized list. I saw Bruce wrote down, I think our health evidence review committee is still responsible for that. Have we gone down the road of looking for federal waivers, what you have been talking about? Not necessarily. I think part of it is just understanding the provisions in Medicaid law of what we, you know, have a responsibility to. What I will say, though, is that if you're looking at what's happening at the local level within CCOs, they are now incentivized to figure out new models of care for some of those high-cost patients. And that we're seeing that right now, where nobody really had those incentives before. So, I mean, they played the game of hot potato, of kind of passing them off to somebody else who had to have those take on those costs. Well, now, within a global budget, I've got to have a hospital and providers and others and county folks really talking to each other to develop a new care model that's going to preserve those global funds. So that, I think that is in everybody's best interest to figure out, is this, you know, a better way that we can get value out of those tax dollars we're spending on health care?
So my question has to do with a couple of the points that were made. One of them talked about improve health, and the other one talks about design to encourage wellness. And I guess I'm trying to understand the relationship, because in many cases, the early part seems to be trying to improve health before we get there, but I'm still trying to understand, so how do we get to the, both within the cost structure and all we're trying to do, that we do this improve health, but at the same time encourage wellness. I just don't understand those components, I guess.
Right. Chair Greenlick, Representative Lively, I think, much of this has to do initially with our first steps of what we're holding CCOs accountable to. And I think, you know, they're really starting to look at some different ways of having expenditures from their global budget to do just that. So one example that, you know, we have been looking at has been occurring down in your area, down in Eugene, and the CCO in that area is now taking a portion of their global budget and directing it to the local public health department for tobacco cessation purposes. We've never had anything like that happen in the past. But part of the reason they're doing that is because of the outcome metrics that they're going to be held accountable to. So we actually have kind of a redirection of funds going upstream to actually get to those health improvement measures.
I'd like to put a question on the air, and you may not be the right one, Bruce may be. But you had the same slide, local accountability and flexibility. How we balance local accountability with flexibility, something you can weave into your story. You can say, you can talk specifically about it.
Sure. Chair Greenlick, I think when I look at what is happening around the state and I think of local accountability and flexibility, local accountability is that you have one single point of accountability. You have a CCO and you have a CCO board that is now responsible for those outcome metrics. And I think, you know, how they want to manage that global budget and how they want to develop their new models of care, that's kind of the flexibility that they now have. Not everybody's doing it the same way. You know, some are using community health workers differently than others. Some are, you know, developing a complex care model differently than others. So I think that's the flexibility that we wanted to have. But on the accountability side, you gotta live within your global budget, and you're going to have to hit your key metrics.
Let me add to that. For the record, Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Oregon Health Authority. We've not only has that been an issue locally, it's actually been an issue with the feds, the whole issue of accountability and flexibility. So let me give you an example. We right now measure accountability by counting services. We count doctor visits, medicines, et cetera. We want to go towards an accountability that really focuses on outcomes. So we're trying to figure out how we can account for some of the kinds of flexible services that aren't traditionally counted. Take the example of a child with asthma. What the feds would like us to do is to continue to count the numbers of doctor visits and medicines they're on. We're actually more interested in being able to show how children are healthier, how they're using less doctor services, using less medicine in the hospital less. And that's created a disconnect because in the past, the federal government has measured their accountability for Medicaid dollars based on people using care. So if we don't show that you're seeing the doctor more, they think, oh, perhaps we haven't been doing our job as a state. We've taken Medicaid money, and we haven't provided the services, as opposed to showing that we're using less care, children are in the emergency department less. And that's really been the tension between some of the flexibility and accountability.
But here's the heart of my question. Are we going to let them do anything they want in the process as they go forward just so they meet outcome measures? And let me just give you an example. I'm not convinced that all of the CCOs are using the community advisory committees in the same way. Are we saying, well, okay, you don't have to. We're not going to tell you anything about that. We're going to not tell you anything about what meetings are open and what meetings are closed. We're not going to tell you anything about how you contract with hospitals. We're not going to tell you anything. We're not going to hold you to anything in process. All you have to do is meet these outcome measures however you get to them. I mean, that's the balance I'm talking about, the balance between having some input into the process they're using to achieve the outcomes, or is it just you guys go for it?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, we have some guidelines and some sideboards. This isn't just about total flexibility. There are stipulations in contract. We are right now in the process of reviewing transformation plans that the CCOs are providing us with. And the process is not only do we look at those and review those and have some back and forth, but those actually get turned into contract amendments where there's some expectations for delivery on how some of the items in those plans will be met. So there's flexibility, but then there's accountability for how you are going to deliver within the flexibilities that you've been given as an organization.
And Chair Greenlick, what I would also add on to Bruce's comment regarding the contract, I mean, part of the provisions that we've had, you know, laid out for those advisory councils really have been around a health needs assessment and a health improvement plan. And our expectation is that we can begin to incorporate, you know, those elements of the health improvement plan into the contract so we can actually see that moving forward.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yes.
We're talking about flexibility and accountability. How do the 40-some mandates that we have in statute against the federal mandate, how does that all play out? I mean, it doesn't seem like we have a lot of flexibility there in a lot of ways.
Chair Greenlick, Rep. Thompson.
Did it go to 40? Oh, no.
Members of the we certainly have some services that are required to be provided, and that's folded into our global budget. We're really in a transitional stage where I believe part of what we're trying to do is set a model for the rest of the nation about how you start to transition from mandates of services towards achieving outcomes and allowing the flexibility to do that. That's going to take quite a bit of time. My guess is that's going to happen over the next decade, but we do fold those into our coordinated care organizations, and I think we'll see those evolve as we move forward.
I think I know the answer to this, but on that same vein, where do we go with additional Oregon mandates? What does that do to us in how everything fits together?
Chair Greenlick, Rep. Thompson.
Could we think of that some? I'm not suggesting that, but...
Yes, I think we have to consider very seriously mandates, and what we're trying to do is have a process where we've got an outcomes and metrics group, and we move from mandating services to really having a group that thoughtfully mandates or requires the kinds of outcomes from care that we want. And that's the transition we're making, and we need to very seriously consider those issues.
And Chair Greenlick, Representative Thompson, one thing we'll have Barney touch on as well on Wednesday would be the ACA provisions around essential health benefit and how that incorporates, you know, the impact of the market on mandates and others.
I worry a little bit that we tell the CCOs, we want you to go forth and do good, but by the way, here's the hobbles we're putting around your legs as you do it,
right?
You know, making sure that we don't defeat our purpose.
We're trying hard not to have that happen.
We have a bill against horse tripping. We can probably apply. We have a bill against horse tripping.
Yes, I saw that one.
Mr. Chair, if I could, real quick.
Go ahead.
This is probably for you, Bruce, or Dr. Goldberg. Sorry.
Bruce is
fine.
Perfect.
What are we looking at for accountability measures for dollars being spent? The only reason it's kind of weird, this is time in my life where I wouldn't be thinking I would be running into this so much, but I have a grandmother who's 98. I have stepfather fell.
I have a grandmother
broke
who's 98.
Grandmother.
Grandmother.
So, hey, our tree doesn't fork a lot out where I'm from, but anyhow, we've seen where he'd fallen, broke his hip. People are showing up saying, can you put your underwear on and stuff? And he's like, would you just get out of my house? Leave me alone. And he's seeing $900 bills left with him. And I'm wondering how much what we're doing to watch possibly the fleecing of the system, too, for people providing needs that people don't really need, just so they can make money off of this revenue that's coming through. And then we've seen, and it gets kind of back to where Representative Greenlick was going, a lot of money used for not care of people that have been put into lots of other funds out there, and a lot of money going into political contributions, too. And this is stuff that taxpayers don't want done with their dollars. What are we doing to monitor that and watch it?
Rep Greenlick, Rep Widener, members of the committee, not only are we looking at the health outcome piece, but within these global budgets, we do have an accounting of where those dollars get spent. And indeed, that is one of the things we will look at very closely. This isn't simply about not going over the global budget, but part of the issue is to be certain that the dollars that go into that global budget are used appropriately for healthcare services and for the community benefit as laid out through Medicaid, and there will be quarterly reports that do show where those dollars go. So it's not, it isn't just a budget and then no accountability to that. There's actually an ability to drill down into that and show exactly where all those dollars went.
I may point, Dr. Goldberg.
Okay, so speaking of drilling down a little bit more, what I'm going to spend the next bit doing is really taking us to the platform of federal reform as it pertains to Medicaid. I think the discussion we've just had is certainly, if we're going to look at the opportunities in federal reform for expanding coverage to Medicaid, we want to be certain that we put individuals into a system which is functioning efficiently and effectively. Right now, our Medicaid program covers approximately 650,000 individuals, and those are primarily children, children up to 300% of the federal poverty level, categorically eligible adults. And what we mean by categorically eligible adults is they have some sort of category that makes them eligible for Medicaid, not just simply income. They're pregnant women, individuals that are disabled, blind, etc. Those categories, along with meeting a certain income standard, make you eligible for Medicaid. And then the last group, which are what we call non-categorical adults. Those are adults who don't have any of those categories that make you eligible for Medicaid, and they qualify for the health plan based on income. Right now, that is our Oregon Health Plan standard population. These are adults living below the poverty level. We don't currently have the funding to cover all those people. There are approximately 120,000 individuals, adults living below the poverty level who would be eligible for the health plan today. We are covering half of those, about 60,000, through the lottery. So that's our lay of the land today. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How do you choose those? Who's the 50% that get it?
Chair Greenlick, Rep. Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. We have a lottery. And individuals put their right in and put their name in a pool. And every month we have been...
Eligibility is determined first.
Correct. No, no. Actually, first they put their name in, then we draw it out, and then we determine eligibility. But individuals who think they may be eligible are able to send us their name. Every month, based on the number of spots, we draw names out of that pool. We determine whether or not people are eligible. And the reason we do that is sometimes someone may have put their name in 6-8 months ago and their eligibility status may have changed. And names are drawn out. We have a certain number that we draw each month, and it's literally a random drawing of names out of a pool. I don't know how many are in our giant fishbowl now, but we had at one point up to 100,000 names in that, and we were drawing names out of that.
So one more question. And why is it that we don't cover everyone, just our OHP budget?
It's been a funding issue. When the Oregon Health Plan started, we covered all those individuals. When the Oregon Health Plan began in 92, it covered all adults under 100% of poverty. In 2000, and I believe it was 2003, during that recession, the state ran out of money. And at that point, we cut almost all of those individuals off of coverage. We had about 25,000, went down to a low of 25,000 in that program. And since that time, we've been able to now fund it up to 60,000 on the hospital assessment, which you'll hear about on Monday. But that's been what has been paying for OHP standard. And you'll see, and actually the next slide, a little bit more about that. Hold that thought. What the ACA allows us to do now, as Mike had indicated, is to expand coverage to all adults up to 138% of poverty. We cover children up to 300. And what federal reform does is mandate that we, in order to expand coverage, states have to maintain what they're currently doing. So we need to maintain coverage for children up to 300% of poverty in our Medicaid program, and then we can expand to adults up to 138%. And the figures are there for a single person, that's $15,800 a year, and for a family of four, $32,000. Yes?
So will the federal subsidy cover that 50% that are eligible but not covered by us at this point?
Correct. It will actually cover all of them.
It will cover the 100 to 138, but I was wondering if it will also cover the 60,000.
It will cover the 60,000 that are already on there.
Okay.
And the 60,000 that aren't covered.
I just want to make sure they're not penalizing us and picking up their share of what they think we should have been doing.
No, and right. Part of the reason for that, we're waiting final approval, is because the benefit that we provide in OHP standard isn't a full benefit and doesn't meet the federal requirement for an essential health benefit. And I'll get into that in a moment. Okay. But so if you go to the next slide, you can actually see some of those finances.
Actually, Bruce, real quick, if you could get us the number on the 300% for the children, can we get an idea of how many had coverage before, or maybe the Oregon Health Plan has now moved to the first and the parents have insurance on the child but moved it to second because they had a deductible and they decided to use the Oregon Health Plan so they didn't have to pay a deductible? So how many are double insured or were removed off of insurance where the parents are covered under the work plan but it costs $300 to have their kids on so they took them off? Because I know I actually, for 300%, I actually might qualify for that myself.
Rep. Wyden, we can get you that. I think what you're referring to is when we expanded coverage up to 300%, there perhaps were some individuals that were covered who dropped coverage. And I will see if I can get that number. I don't have it off the top of my head.
Thank you.
So if we go to the next slide, what we did in order to have a recent conversation about this opportunity for the state for expansion. As Mike indicated to you, this is fully federally funded for the next 3 years. But after that, it goes down to 90-10 match. And so the question has been, what over the next seven, 8 years, is are we signing up? First, let me point out that states, what the Supreme Court decision about the Affordable Care Act did was allow states the choice of expanding. It was, states now have a choice of whether to expand or not. If the one issue is that it's all or none. You can't, as a state, expand up to 100% of poverty if you're covering people only up to 50%. You've got to go all in. But the other issue, which I think is germane to the conversation, is states can, at any point, move out from expansion and go back to their original coverage. One of the, I think, issues that's often come up is, well, we know now that it's going down to 90-10. What if it goes to 50-50 and the federal deal substantially changes? If that's the case, the state is not locking itself into a long-term commitment, but the state can decide not to expand. But again, that is all out. The state can't go from 138% down to 100 if they've expanded. You go back to your previous coverage. So with that as sort of the paradigm, what we did is had some outside groups look at what the funding would be between 2014 and 2020, when in essence we go down to 90-10. And I call your attention to the first column, which is the effect on general fund and what this does. First, we looked at what the cost to the state would be. And the cost to the state in terms of general fund are approximately $591 million through 2020. That comes from two places. One is $433 million due to the state's portion of covering what we estimate will be about 180,000 people coming into the health plan, plus the 60,000 that are already there in OHP standard. The other piece of that is that there is sort of the, what Rep. Widener was referring to, there's what we call a welcome mat phenomenon, that when you go out and people understand that there's an opportunity for healthcare coverage, some people come into coverage who may not have been there before, but were eligible before. And that's another $158 million for a total of $591. So that would be the cost of the state through 2020.
Can I ask those 60,000 that are currently eligible but didn't win the lottery, do they fall under the 433 or the 158?
They fall into two places. If you look at the second column, we free up about a billion dollars that we would pay for those individuals over the next biennium, because they will be covered fully by federal funds through 2016. And then after 2016, the state will be responsible for an increasing share up to 10%.
So let me ask one more.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure you just answered my question, but I didn't quite understand it. So rather than focus on the numbers, the dollars, the 180,000 that are the people that are going to be new to the program, mm-hmm. up to 138,000, does that include the 60,000 that did not win the lottery?
No.
Yet.
The
so then you said plus 60,000.
Who
did not win
the lottery?
No, there are about 180,000 people who will come in new to coverage,
including
60,000 people currently covered.
So the 180,000 that are new, 60,000 of those would be the ones that didn't win the lottery, and 120,000 of those are from 100 to 138% of poverty?
Yes.
Now, it's approximately of the 180,000,
mm-hmm.
120,000 are below poverty, and about 60,000 of them are between 100 and 138. 30. Does that...
Well...
It's about a two-thirds...
Numbers don't add up, but it's okay.
You confuse me now.
No.
You are saying that there are people below 100% who are not currently in Standard or on the lottery.
Correct.
That's where that number comes from.
Kind of 60.
So it includes the 60 plus another 60, roughly, who are neither in the lottery nor in OSB Standard now, that are under 100%. Right?
We estimate that under 100% of poverty today, there are about 120,000 people who will come on to the plan over the next couple of years, in addition to the 60 that are on there.
But that other ones includes people currently waiting to get into OAC.
Correct. That's not everybody.
A third are waiting, and another third haven't even put their names in the hat. That's
correct. Not everybody has put their name in the hat.
In fact, 100%.
We don't. I don't have an accurate. I don't have in my head today a number I could tell you how many are in that waiting list.
So the 180,000 new are 60 that are on the waiting list, 60 that are eligible currently but don't even have their names in the lottery, and another 60,000 that are between 100 and 138,000, 100% of poverty, roughly.
Roughly.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
But we only open the waiting list. We...
That's enough of that.
That's
pressure.
All right. Yeah. Never mind.
Let's go on.
Okay. Thank you. 591 is the cost over the next 7 years. But there's also some offsets to the state. And let me go through those. The net is that this is about 79 million. If you skip to the bottom, the offsets put this to the point where this will be about $79 million to the positive for the state. And that's for the following reasons. There's about a $24 million savings for individuals that we currently cover under 60-40 match, who in essence will get covered under 90-10 match. There is about $200 million, actually $204, that we've estimated currently are state general fund dollars that go to programs to cover health care expenses for the uninsured outside of Medicaid that are unmatched. Examples of that are dollars that go to counties for mental health care coverage for the indigent. We've taken a very, very conservative number here and backed out what is about half of those expenditures, understanding that well over half of the uninsured will now be covered. So that's some additional general fund money. We also know that costs are often shifted from the uninsured onto the commercially insured. You've heard that hospitals, doctors who provide care for the uninsured, they don't do that for free. They build those costs into what the rest of us pay. There has been some outside analysis and a very, very conservative figure of 1.7% of the commercial premium is attributable to the costs of the uninsured. Some other studies have shown that to be as high as 10%. We pegged that at 1.7%. Now, we can't as a state put our hands on that bit of the premium that businesses pay, but we can for what we as a state pay for public employees as well as for teachers. And so that $93 million is a figure that we estimate that we can account for in our contract negotiations for PEB and OEB benefits through 2020. That brings us down to $321 million of savings against the $591. Lastly, we are bringing in, as you can see in the third column, about $11.5 billion of new federal revenue to cover these 180,000 individuals. That revenue coming into the state creates jobs. It creates jobs in our healthcare system to help cover those individuals. There's an accepted national model that our Department of Revenue and others use to account for the economic activity from that. And that's estimated to bring in about $349 million of new tax revenue from the increased economic activity over the next 7 years from that $11 billion of federal money. Some of that will go into people's pockets and they buy cars and household goods, et cetera. So the total net effect on this expansion is approximately $79 million in savings to the state. What I would point out is all of this is on top of what we've done with our healthcare transformation and our ability to deliver Medicaid services more effectively. This would not be as much in our favor if we had not instituted the savings that we're currently getting in with our CCOs. So that's the financial side of this. There's also a human impact. And that human impact, as I indicated, is approximately 180,000 uninsured adults will come onto the health plan and get health care coverage. As I indicated, about approximately 180,000 uninsured adults over the next biennium. About two-thirds of those individuals are living below poverty, and about one-third of those are living below 50% of poverty.
So, Bruce?
Yes.
So for a grand total, that's going to put us at about 900,000?
About close to that, correct, Rep. Widener.
So a total cost of $11.6 billion for 900,000?
That 11.6 is only the federal dollars coming in for what will be 180,000 plus over the next 7 years. It's the new uninsured. It's the uninsured. It's the 180,000 over the next 7 years. It's that $11 billion. The cost to the health plan are much greater than $11 billion over the next 7 years.
So that's just for 180,000?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
May I suggest we buy them all an insurance policy?
Yeah, no, the federal government buy them insurance policy because we're not buying this policy.
We above 138% of poverty is actually the day two, that's Wednesday, and that is indeed what the paradigm of federal reform is that below 138% of poverty is in Medicaid. And above 138%, as you'll see, is a subsidized commercial health insurance policy, subsidized up to 400% of poverty. So in addition to covering 180,000 people, as I indicated, there'll be a diminished cost shift to those with insurance. We capture some of that on the state side, but the rest of the population will see a benefit to that. And then the last piece is something we've been talking about quite a bit, which I think is going to have a huge impact in our state, which is the fact that right now we spend a substantial amount of money providing primarily mental health and addiction treatment through a number of programs, through county mental health departments, through mental health and drug courts, and through community corrections programs that primarily provide those services straight general fund or other funds without a federal match. Now individuals will have those services covered through the Oregon Health Plan. Someone who goes into mental health court or drug court. And right now, many of our drug court slots are limited because of the ability to pay for treatment slots. Most of those treatment slots will now be covered through the health plan. So there's going to be a benefit to community corrections, to county mental health and addiction programs, as well as to mental health and drug courts. So we do have to make some program changes if we're going to expand, and that gets at the bills that we'll need to pass. The program changes are first and foremost, we're currently building a much more efficient eligibility and enrollment system for Medicaid. That's through our work with Cover Oregon, the insurance exchange. And one of the things that separates us out from a state from other states is that we're creating a single point of entry for individuals so that regardless of their income, individuals will come through a single portal, a single website, or a single customer service line, which will then determine their eligibility for Medicaid if they're below 138% of poverty, and for the insurance exchange if they're above that, and it will enroll them in either of those programs. In most other states, you go through one door, and if you don't qualify through that door, it bounces you to another door, and you have to start the process all over again. So we're creating a more efficient eligibility system. And the other piece that we need to do is to create a single OHP benefit package. The reason for that really gets at what Rep. Kenny Geyer mentioned before, was our Oregon Health Plan standard benefit package doesn't meet the federal requirement for an essential health benefit package. That the silver lining to that is because of that, the feds will consider those people currently in OHP newly eligible because they don't currently have a Medicaid package that meets federal requirements. But we have to have an essential benefit package for Medicaid. We had a public process where the Medicaid Advisory Committee looked at a variety of options and in essence landed on the Oregon Health Plan Plus benefit package as it is today. So we need some program changes to enact that. And there's one other piece I want to spend a little bit of time on, and that's about families and children. On the left-hand side there, my left, what you can see is currently, as I indicated, we cover all children up to 300% of poverty. When come January 1, when the exchange happens, their parents will be in Cover Oregon. Children will still be required to be in our Medicaid program. Right now, that Medicaid program has two options. One is under 200% in the Oregon Health Plan, and we have about 7,000 children in Kids Connect, which is a subsidized commercial health insurance program. That's a very expensive program to administer, and we are unable at this time, through that single portal, which I indicated would sign people up for Medicaid or the exchange, we couldn't, given the time we have, design also an opportunity for parents to sign their children up with Healthy Kids Connect. As a result, what we are proposing is moving all children under 300% to the Oregon Health Plan, and that's for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's going to make it easier for families. Number two, it will be less expensive for the state to administer. Number three, it's a better value for the families. And we found that one of the biggest reasons children have fallen off of the Healthy Kids Connect program has been an inability to afford some of the premium and cost sharing there. What we hope in the long term is an opportunity to allow families to be in the same health plan, that children in families between 138% of poverty and above to either be able to be in the Oregon health plan or have a choice to be on the insurance exchange. There is an ability for us as a state to do that, to allow parents to, in essence, use what is currently the federal and state CHIP Medicaid payment to purchase coverage on the insurance exchange. We can't do that come January 1. We're hoping we can enact that in 2015 or 2016. And part of that is just, that's a workload and a technology issue. We are, as I think many of you know, struggling mightily to meet that January 1 deadline for the information systems for the insurance exchange. And to do that...
The October 1 deadline.
Oh, the October 1 deadline, correct. We go live October 1. And in order to do that, we've had to make some clear scope delineations. And so some things which we'd like to do, we can do, but not by October 1, but in the next year or two. So that is the long-range plan for that. So in order to accomplish all that, we have two bills. One is House Bill 2859, which we'll go through in some detail later in the week. But this bill, in essence, aligns state law with changes to the federal Medicaid law. And they are such things as there is a new way that income is counted. It goes to modified adjusted gross income from what was a different way of accounting for family income. We need to clarify the responsibilities for enrollment and eligibility information between the state programs and Cover Oregon. And we need to align state law with what will be new federal law come January 1, 2014. It's very much a technical bill that aligns us with federal Medicaid law and really has no bearing on whether we expand or not. We would need to make these changes whether or not the state chose to expand or not. The other bill makes the changes to have all children below 300% covered in the Oregon Health Plan. When the Healthy Kids Program was set up, it statutorily set up the Healthy Kids Connect program between 200 and 300% of poverty. And so in order to make the change that we're proposing would require that we have a statutory change to, in essence, end the Healthy Kids Connect program and have all children below 300% of poverty in the state's Medicaid program. So let me stop there.
I'm assuming there'd be no lapse in coverage for those kids during the transition.
Chair Greenlick, Rep. Kenny Geyers, members of the committee, no, there would be no lapse in coverage. How we are proposing to administer that is that we would stop new enrollment in October. And as children come up for redetermination at a yearly basis, staggered throughout the year, as they come up for redetermination, they would be transferred into the Oregon Health Plan, so they would not lose coverage.
Jim Conger.
Thank you. I didn't ask you this ahead of time. I have a couple of questions and comments on this, but How much, do you know off the top of your head, how much we're receiving right now from the federal government in, I'm going to say this, I don't mean it in a denigrating way, but in kickbacks for our transformation out of the $1.9 billion that Oregon was awarded? How much are we receiving in this biennium?
Chair Greenlech, Rep. Conger, members of the committee, I can tell you the figure for next biennium right off the top of my head, $910 million of that $1.9 billion. And I believe for this current biennium, it's something less of that, about $600 million or so.
Let me briefly explain the reason for the question. You know, it strikes me that right now we're not fully affording our Oregon health plan. In other words, there is a big gap in our current and coming budget that is being backfilled by, you know, and credit goes to you two and to the governor for obtaining this backfill because we need it. But as we look to expanding a program that we can't afford right now organically out of our own revenue, I have some real concern about what that means. And so that was the nature of the question. The other thing that I find a little bit confusing and somewhat disturbing is that my impression of Medicaid is it's a safety net program for people who genuinely are in need. And as we look at our current parameters, eligibility guidelines, and we look at expanding them, I'm not saying that 138% of poverty is a lot of money. It's not. But 300% of poverty for a family of four, I get a little north of $70,000 a year. That's still not wealthy. But we're talking about having a safety net program blown up so big that we're calling people eligible who are at 300% of the federal poverty level. That strikes me as, you know, if we're being intellectually honest about this, it's no longer a safety net program. It's just government-provided health insurance for a certain percentage of our population. And I'm not sure that that's the right thing to do. The other part that I am a little concerned about is, you know, we talked about the kids and families having different eligibility levels, so they're moving back and forth. And I appreciate you taking that on because that is a concern. You know, it's hard enough for people to keep track and, you know, can I go to this doctor? And, you know, they're now in different health plans. I think that's a problem. And as they move in and out of eligibility at different levels, I think that creates a lot of complexity and potential for problems for those families. So I am glad to hear that you're working on addressing that. But I'm pretty interested in two things. One is, as we expand this, at what point are we trying to get people off of safety net programs? In other words, you know, if they're working now and they're, you know, they hit 300% of the poverty level because they got a raise, you know, that might be a problem because now they have a huge disincentive to take that raise. And same thing holds true at 138% of poverty. Shouldn't we be looking instead at some kind of overall picture of trying to encourage and help people transition off of this program without giving them a penalty, without bringing more people in where they will have a penalty if they work themselves out of that income guideline?
Chair Greenlech, Rep. Conger, members of the committee, number of sort of points in there. Let me take the last one because I think it's an important one. You're correct. We have created, not just in Medicaid, but in many of our other social and human services programs, some cliffs where you reach a point and then there's a huge drop-off,
right.
and there's actually a disincentive of improving your family status through higher income because you lose many more benefits, whether it be health care, food stamps, other benefits. We totally agree, and I think some of that is federal construct. Having said that, it's an issue, certainly I know that we've talked about, the governor's talked about, and looking at over the next several years, are there some opportunities through federal waivers and some other things to look at the flexibility we may have to smooth some of that out. Right now, we operate within those federal constructs and would agree. They perhaps have some, sometimes we see some disincentive.
Bruce, but the, let me just get in the middle of the discussion, it's a very important discussion. At 138%, it's not a big cliff. Because at 139%, they would have a heavily subsidized option in the exchange. And we're talking about how to deal with that population. The 300% is a different issue. There is a big cliff there.
But there is a drop-off. I think the issue is somebody going from 137 to 139%, I think the issue is they still will, in essence, lose disposable income by moving up in the economic scale. And so how can we minimize the disruption from that?
Chair Greenlee, Representative Conner, the 2 points I had down, one, this kind of your 300% piece, I think is fair, but when you talk about this in terms of the expansion of the safety net, and you're thinking of the safety net specifically being Medicaid, I think I would want to make sure that we're clear that really right now we're talking about up to 138%. And so when we talk about that 300, you're talking about a program that you already have in place with FEOP. I mean, this is what we have, and this has kind of been a very unique program of the state. Well, now it's really kind of a federal program that we now have subsidies going to buy private health insurance. So when you think about what that can do to the market in terms of driving and increasing competition, I mean, I think there is some value there that we haven't had in the past of taking some uninsured and actually giving them subsidies to access the marketplace. The other piece that you had around the sustainability, I think that's a piece that I would like to probably get into a bigger conversation when we talk about the hospital self-assessment piece, because I think it is important for this group to connect the dots, not just in this biennium, but in the outer years as well. And I think as we've really been looking at this, I think there are some sustainability pieces that I think we feel much more comfortable in now than probably 8 months ago.
Correct. We're moving towards greater. We do have some funding challenges out into the future. Having said that, can show you some work we've been doing that shows that with what we're doing, we are indeed narrowing those. And I think getting to the point where out into the future, hopefully we can move towards greater sustainability. We would be, put differently, we'd be less sustainable now without what we're doing in our Medicaid program today. So the federal funds do pay a dividend in helping us through this time period.
Bruce, if I may on this, because it kind of ties into what all you guys are talking about, just the transition with the kids onto the Oregon Health Plan. One of the big things, and what I worry about, that 300% level of going to an employer who might provide private insurance is the cost shift that goes on. Are we looking at addressing anything with the cost shift in reimbursement rates to doctors on the Medicaid? Because that's the concern I have here, moving them over to OHP. Does Oregon Health Kids reimburse more than what OHP does or Medicaid does? And doctors might be seeing the kid here, now we transfer them over here, and reimbursement rates are less, so the doctor stops seeing them. And that's what drives up the price of private insurance. We just heard a nurse practitioner bill the other day, which is the same thing. They can't make enough off Medicaid, and they are looking at a reduction from private insurance, at some point we have to address this ourselves, and I don't know if that's going to be done here, or are we going to just solely rely on CCOs for that?
Go ahead.
Chair Greenlick, Rep. Widener, members of the committee. Cost shift is a huge issue across the Oregon health plan. And I think that until we get to the point where we can have people getting the same service by the same provider and having it paid for fairly, regardless of whether it's Medicare, Medicaid, commercial insurance, we've got a difficult healthcare system to make good policy changes are. With those 5,000 kids in Healthy Kids Connect, what we've known, quite frankly, is that about a third of those kids have fallen off from coverage and have been uninsured, where there's even less reimbursement. So there's no doubt that there's going to be some change in reimbursement from going from a commercial to an OHP payer. On the other hand, there's going to be many more kids who will have some coverage that is actually sustainable and payment. So we believe that will balance that out to some extent. The biggest reason these families have dropped out of that Healthy Kids Connect program has been they haven't been able to afford it. So there's a balance there.
Are you done with your formal presentation?
Yeah.
I'd like to make sure everybody has a chance to ask questions. So let me start around, if we can, and make sure everybody's had a chance to start with you again.
May I have another shot, or do you want
to? Go ahead. You have another shot.
Okay. So I just had a couple.
That's not fair.
I know that isn't fair, but I appreciate it.
I'm going to give somebody next to you a chance to think up a question.
I give them more time. Yeah. A couple of math questions. I have two. One is, Bruce, I thought you said that 60,000 people who were currently eligible would come in, but were excluded because they didn't win the number in the lottery. But then I saw a slide where 180,000 new people, two-thirds of which were below poverty level and a third of which were below half of poverty level. I'm confused by the math here.
Let me try and go back through that again. I think we had a lot of 60s that got apportioned out. There are currently 60,000 adults on the Oregon Health Plan Standard Program. Those are adults under 138% of poverty, currently covered today on the plan, paid for with the under 100%, paid for with the hospital assessment. If I said that there were 60,000 people on the waiting list, mm-hmm. I don't know how many people are on the waiting list. So what we know mm-hmm. is that there are about 120,000 people below poverty who are not currently covered. They may or may not be on that on a waiting list. Many of them are not on a waiting list, but there are, when you look at under 100% of poverty now, 60,000 on the plan and about 120,000 uninsured today who we believe will come on to coverage. And then in addition, there's about 60,000 adults between 100% of poverty and 138% of poverty who are uninsured who will come onto the health plan. So approximately 180,000 new people to the health plan, and then there are within that poverty range 60,000 people currently covered today who will continue to have coverage, but that will be 100% federally funded for the next 3 years and then gradually decrease.
So you are saying there will be 180,000 under 100% who will be on the health plan, including the 60 and the 120.
Correct.
Half of that 180 you say are below 50% of the poverty line.
Correct. And then another 60 on top of that.
I get that. We're talking about all adults here, obviously, because the kids are already eligible. If I may, the second math question I had was, I really appreciate the level of effort that went into the cost estimate, because I think that's really critical information for me, and I see the level of detail that you went to. The one thing that I meant to ask, I didn't see it in there in a quick scan because I was trying to pay attention. Did you offset any of the subsidy that would come in if some of these folks who are eligible for the higher level of subsidies instead went with commercial insurance on Cover Oregon, under Cover Oregon?
I'm not sure I understand.
So between 100 and 138%, there are people who could buy insurance on the exchange. And they, I think, would be eligible for, generally speaking, on average, for a pretty high level of subsidy to do that. Did you offset the economics here in any way? Did you look at what that subsidy might mean in terms of healthcare dollars spent and other things? Did you plug it into the algorithm that you used to come up with your cost estimate for the state?
Well, the first question is, will people under 138 be allowed to come into the exchange? Or will they be required to move into the health plan?
Chair Greenlick, Rep. Conger, my understanding is that individuals will under 138 are in Medicaid, not in the exchange.
If we opt in, if we opt to raise the eligibility.
Correct.
Okay, so what if we didn't?
If we didn't, then you are, I believe, correct that if you don't, if we did not elect to expand, my understanding, with the caveat that need to do a little homework, is that individuals between 100 and 138 could indeed go on to the exchange. However, and could get covered in that way, we would have a gap in, we wouldn't be able to cover the 120,000 people under 100% of poverty. And that was not, we didn't do an analysis like that. I understand what you're saying.
Okay. So you didn't do the analysis. That's okay. I mean, it's really down in the weeds. I actually didn't expect it. But, there could be an offset there. But I want to be sure that I understood your last statement. Even if we maintain eligibility at 100% or we raise it to 138%, and somebody says, I don't want the Oregon Health Plan, I elect, to go buy the policy and get the subsidy on Cover Oregon. They could buy the policy on Cover Oregon, but they wouldn't get the federal subsidy.
I believe that's correct.
Okay.
We'll double check.
Okay, but thanks.
I thought automatically at the entry, if they're under 138, they automatically go into the health plan. They don't have an option not to.
That's what we believe, too. I think two different issues. One is, if you expand, what happens? The other is, if you don't expand, could individuals, and we didn't do that analysis, it'd be a very different analysis. You'd lose less of the economic benefit from the federal money coming into the state. You would save some general fund expenditure. How that would balance out, not sure.
Let's keep moving. Representative Harker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I, too, find myself focusing on the numbers rather than the improvements in the quality of life and health care. Maybe it's because the co-chair's budget came out earlier today or something. But the table number two that you had up there, and we don't have to go back to it at all. It's the one with all of the columns that show costs and offsets. That's the one right there. These numbers represent cost source savings over a 7-year period, correct?
Correct.
We don't have to go into this now, but if you have those split out by year or biennium, I would love to see them because I'm just thinking
we
through.
We do.
Okay, so if you could forward that to me or perhaps to the committee, that would be helpful. I'm thinking about in particular the $349 million of federal funding and tax revenue coming off of the federal funding revenue. At what time does that start to kick in? And such comments, welcome.
Right. We have that. The tax dollar, the $349 starts 2014. The cost to the general fund don't happen until after 2016, till 2017. Because remember, the first 3 years is fully federally funded.
Right.
So if you look at it by, there are some biennia where we save more money.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Okay, thanks.
Representative Thompson, do you have a question?
Well, we'll deal this moves on, but I'm still really concerned about the difference in coverage and access. And I'd like to, you know, drill down a little farther on how the heck we're going to actually see these people and impact their health care in a positive way. We have to see them to impact their health care. We have to impact their health care to reduce the costs. And I can't make those numbers work on the access end yet. But
that's for Dr. Goldberg to go back to primary care.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that will help or not, but Rep. Greenlick.
You know which end of the stethoscope goes in your mouth, at least.
I'm trying.
Yeah, excellent.
My foot. Rep. Thompson, I think you raise a great question, which we've been actually thinking about quite a bit. And I think the question is, if we bring, and this is just on the Medicaid side, you'll hear Wednesday on the commercial side, bringing, you know, also several hundred thousand people into coverage, how we'll provide that coverage. We have a strategy. One, we know that we can't create primary care providers over the next couple of years.
Yeah.
It takes many years to do that. As a result, we've got a multi-pronged approach. One is efforts by the state to recruit more primary care workforce and retain current workforce. We have a $2 million a year proposal for loan repayment that we believe will, for primary care providers that see Medicaid clients, that will bring more workforce to the state. To retain, we have a tax credit currently for rural primary care providers, as well as we plan to continue the program that helps subsidize the malpractice premiums for rural primary care and OBGYN. So that's another recruitment strategy. We've been making some investments in primary care through our primary care home payments and some other ways, and we're seeing CCOs make some investments in primary care. We believe that will draw more people into primary care. So that's another strategy.
We have more than 300 of those primary care.
We have over 300 now certified patient-centered primary care homes in the state, and I don't have an exact number on the number of physicians. So there's dollars going into them. Third, through primary care redesign, there's pretty good evidence that through restructuring primary care practices, which is currently going on, more group visits, team-based care, more use of telehealth, that you can, some studies have shown you can increase primary care capacity by over 30%. Lastly, we have fortunately in this state invested in a strong safety net over the last 20 years, and have seen a great growth in federally qualified community health centers. Many individuals who will be coming into coverage are currently getting care in those facilities. So we think we've got a strategy to get us through that, and hopefully it'll work.
Move this way.
My next, thank you. I'm wondering, the mental health folks that you said we've been paying for out of general funds through the counties and now will be folded into the Medicaid, did this show up anywhere in savings or in leveraged federal dollars on this chart? I couldn't figure out a category.
It's the 204.
204.
That it's the savings to state programs for the uninsured.
Okay.
And yeah, in this biennium, we in the governor's budget, approximately $45 million. Not this biennium, next biennium, 13-15, about $45 million. And what the governor's budget does is actually reinvest that back into the mental health system.
Representative Kenemer?
I think I'm okay for the moment.
So I have just two quick things. One, I want clarification on the moving of the kids who are currently covered, and you talked about some of them falling off because they can't afford it. So we're going to move them over to the system. So how does that change from the standpoint of the risk to those kids?
Chair Greenlick, Rep. Lively, members of the committee, these are kids who are in a commercial health insurance program. Okay. And the reason that many of them churn in and out of it is their family's economic circumstances change, and they can't afford the premium or the cost sharing. Sure. And so they churn off. And we believe that by having these kids in Medicaid, you know, there'll be less churn and there'll be a much more stable population.
So just one more quick question. So, because I wasn't here when this all started, but when I hear full federal funding for 3 years, I guess I have some concern of what the risk of that is given the status of the federal budget. Mm-hmm. I mean, what's the guarantee? Because that's obviously a huge piece to any of this working.
Chair Greenlick, Rep. Lively, there is no guarantee. That can change at any moment. But as I indicated, so can the state.
Right.
That if we choose to expand under a 100% federal funding construct for 3 years and the federal deal changes, we can as a state back out of that arrangement. And there is no guarantee.
This isn't a part of the sequester, though, is it? That would be a different act.
Correct. Medicaid funding was not a part of the sequestration.
No, the sequestration. No, but I understand
it could
that.
Change.
Right.
Did you have another question?
No.
Representative Widener, you get the last.
Anybody got something damaging they want me to throw at them?
You know, I think you'd be brief, whatever it is.
I got 20 minutes, so.
No, you don't. We have 5 minutes.
You know, Bruce, I think it's pretty clear with everybody up here. I mean, the finances is the big thing because we're only looking at a third of the population, even with the expansion that we're covering. And if the federal funds run out, we're looking at doubling tax rates on all Oregonians just to cover a third of the population. So, and that's a very large number that should scare Oregonians outside this building, watching their tax rate go from 10 to 20%. So I'm just wondering, are there any plans or anything that are that's going
on?
A
plan for that tax increase? I'd be happy to sign on with you.
We're still only covering a third of the population.
It's tobacco.
I'm just wondering if there are any plans, like, for a whole system where it's just a government-run plan where everybody could jump in, all businesses, every Oregonian would have the opportunity for that, or if that's
John
not being
DiLorenzo
discussed.
John DiLorenzo has a plan for that. You should check in with him.
I saw that text.
As a way of economic development. Very interesting.
Rep. Greenlick, Chair Greenlick, Rep. Widener, members of the committee, you know, we've been, no matter what kind of system we have that pays for care, one system for everybody, this state-federal partnership or whatever, it's the underlying cost of care and inefficiency of our healthcare system that is going to be the Achilles heel of any system. And so what we've really been focusing on in earnest through the CCOs and all that we've been doing is to try and create a better value, lower cost, more affordable, and sustainable healthcare system.
Hold on a minute. Before I notice we're losing some of the audience, I want to remind everybody, if you want to sign up for public testimony on any of the four bills we're talking about on Friday, you need to get that information to our administrator, Mr. Lawson, by the end of Wednesday. I'll remind people again during the Wednesday hearing, but we want to know what we're going to have, and we want to be able to organize things efficiently. I'm sorry, Bruce, go ahead.
Oh, so we've been trying to make healthcare more affordable, more sustainable, regardless of the payment system. We haven't been formulating any plans to that nature. We've been dealing with what is right now this federal construct and trying to work within that.
You guys did a great job today. We'll look forward to Barney, who I think there are several people here who don't know Barney, the preeminence of healthcare, who's has been involved in these things since the 2003 session. He was the one who managed the night meetings that got us the hospital self-assessment in those days. So
we've learned a lot from him.
We look forward to that. And we'll be announcing the Friday agenda. Yeah, and next hour. So you'll know there are three bills. The fourth bill, we don't have a number on. It will be, we'll be introducing it as a committee bill Wednesday. And those are the four bills we'll be taking public testimony on Friday, and hopefully moving soon after, because several of them go to Ways and Means. We need to get them in process. Thank you very much. Great job, guys. We are adjourned.